It's a movement, but it's about people. Be the People is about we the people joining forces to reclaim and reshape the best of our nation's time-treasured traditions. Each week, we offer insightful interviews with movers and shakers from all different spheres of life. And now, please welcome Dr. Carol Swain.
I'm so excited today to be with my guest, Charles Love. Charles is a Black conservative who, like many other Black conservatives, started life as a Democrat. But unlike many of us, he came to his awareness at a much younger age. Charles is the author of Logic, The Truth About Blacks and the Republican Party, and he has a new book entitled We Want Equality, How the Fight for Equality Gave Us Preferences. And he will tell us also about a summit that he's organizing in the fall. So help me welcome Charles Love to the Be the People show.
Hello. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So Charles, you have been a conservative for a while, a Black conservative, and there's not that many of us in the country, or at least that's what we're told. And so when did you become self-aware of the fact that maybe, just maybe, the Democratic Party wasn't the only game in town?
Well, first I'd like to say I'm glad you added the piece as about what they'd like us to know, so we'll get to that part later. But as far as when I became aware, I think technically it was early on, but it should have been earlier, but there was no outreach. So I grew up in a traditional family that were all Democrats, but we had traditional, what we would call conservative values. So when I got of age to vote and started to pay attention to what was going on, I kept hearing about this two-party system. I'm like, you know, I was always a logical person, so I said, let's find out what the other party has to say. But being born and raised in Gary, Indiana, which is predominantly Democrat and Black, the Republicans didn't really come and ask for my vote. So I didn't start voting for Republicans right away, but I did start to live out my traditional values and lean to the right. So I worked my way through independence and when I'm in my 20s and eventually just said I'm not voting for Democrats anymore, regardless of the fact that the Republicans aren't asking for my vote.
Now, Charles, did you know any Republicans growing up?
No, it's funny. Well, it didn't really come up. You know, it's not like it is today where everybody wears a party label on their chest and always talking about a party. It's like that side is bad. It's just kind of we live life the way Americans live life. So it didn't really come up about a party system. So, but when I did hear it, it was always Democrat. Once it came around election time, you got to vote for the Democrats. You got to vote for the Democrats. I had one friend whose mother was somewhat conservative, never knew her to be a Republican, but he was the first one. I think we were 19, and he was walking around like, I am a card-carrying member of the Republican Party. Of course, we looked at him like, not even, we didn't knock him like you would today. We looked at him like, what does that even mean? What is he talking about? Go ahead. We don't even know what that means. And he is still very active in Indiana politics, and so he was the only person growing up that I would say was an actual Republican.
Now, how old were you when Ronald Reagan was elected?
When he was elected the first time, I was 9. So I was in high school when his second term ended. It's amazing how those 2 8 years could, at that age in your life, can span most of your childhood.
And I would say, as someone, you know, who was older when Reagan was elected, much older, the whole theme of mourning in America. You know, he talked about making America great again, and the country was so demoralized from the things that had happened under Jimmy Carter. There was something about that Reagan era that gave a lot of people hope. I wonder if it influenced you in some sort of way.
That's interesting. I hadn't really thought of it because I think that it was just a little bit different then in that. So by his second term, I was hearing the kind of things. But you know, I think back. I was going to say I was hearing the things he wanted to do, and they made sense to me. I didn't listen to them as Republican or conservative versus Democrat. It's like, yeah, that makes sense. But there is, I did forget that that there were obviously voices in the community talking about, you know, just like the media does now, wasn't as much of it then, kind of skewing things. So we did hear all the trickle-down economics and all this, he only is trying to help the rich kind of stuff. So there were whispers of that, but at my age, being high school, it was just kind of like, oh, I'm still learning and taking it in. At that point, we weren't being indoctrinated, so people would just say, this is what's in the news, you do it what you want. So I was kind of like, well, it's got to be more to it than that. So I didn't really take it as ominous as people tried to make it out to be.
Well, you've clearly been motivated by a strong desire to educate blacks about conservative values and principles, and you've done that through writing and through speaking and videos. So could you tell us about when you actually started speaking before groups and writing books, and what has been the reception from the people that you have met?
Okay, yeah. So I was like, we'll talk about my breakdown of how I split the conservatives into three groups. So I call them the people in the silos, the warriors, and the sleepers. I was a sleeper for many years. That means I go out and I listen to what's going on. I vote for the Republican, and I went on about my life. I would hear people debating stuff, and like many people, hopefully some will wake up listening to this today. Like many of you, I was like, I would hear things that people would say. I was like, that's just silly. That doesn't make sense. And I would just nod my head, and I thought that was enough, right? Didn't think I needed to act. That's somebody else's job. But then Obama won, and that was really interesting for me. And I looked at it slightly different from most conservatives. I was old enough at that point that I knew I was a hardened conservative, and I didn't agree with his policies when he was running, so I didn't vote for him either time. But many conservatives, while he was in office and since, have attacked him as being a bad president, being too leftist and all this other things. Not that I don't agree with that, but that wasn't the biggest problem. What I think the biggest problem of the Obama presidency was is the perception and the hopes and the expectations of the people who did vote for him. So what made it was beyond even the bad he may or may not have done. It was they lifted him up so high that nobody was going to be able to live up to his expectations. So when he didn't, it became, we got a reaction we didn't think we would get. So like, I was read one of your books, and it was wonderful information where you talk about, where you kind of prophesied all of the stuff that was going to happen in white America because of all the things that was going to happen, that at some point people were going to push back. Well, it was kind of a different version of that, right? It was black people saying for years that there'll never be a black president, this country's too racist. Then they got one. They're like, okay, maybe there's hope. But then when nothing changed, they didn't just go back to, well, maybe he would have done a better job. They're like, see, that means even if he couldn't do it, nothing's ever going to happen. So I think they got more cynical and more negative than they ever were before, because they had such high hopes that had been dashed. Well, and that I think, even though I don't agree with him, I don't think he could have controlled that, because they would have done that anyway. There were people walking around election day saying, I'm not going to have to pay my phone bill now.
I know. I saw that video. The lady said she wasn't going to have to pay rent anymore, and she thought that right. He was going to just continue to give handouts. And there were some people that benefited financially from the election of President Obama. And what I find most interesting is that the people, no matter what he did, I heard people say, well, he would have done more for black people if white people had not held him back. And then when President Trump, you know, got elected and things started turning around in the economy and blacks and Hispanics started benefiting, now they're saying it was Obama. And so either way, you know, Obama has had a major impact on America. But with black America, I don't think they have been able to come to full terms with the fact that his presidency was a mixed bag. It benefited some groups more than others. And for black Americans, there was very little that trickled down to them. I think he could have done a lot more to bring Americans together when it came to race relations. I think he drove us further apart through his policies, and how the members of his administration reacted to highly salient public events.
Well, yeah, that's true, but going back to your original question was, why did I start writing? That's why I started writing, because all that's true about him and Obama as a politician. But the issue was really the people, because no one had that foundation. Everything comes from a foundation, right? You were raised in your family. Everything has to start there. So these people weren't paying attention to politics before, right? They were living a life. They were doing whatever. It wasn't important to them. He wins, and now they become political scholars overnight. So they have no basis and nothing to compare it to, because they don't know what history says. So when they see a conservative politician saying that Obama's not doing a good job, and they then say, well, that's unusual. He's getting more attacked than any other president in history. Nobody's ever had to deal with that. So they don't know about the 7 presidents that were shot. Right?
You're right.
So I think that's a big attack, you know, trying to hating someone so much that you tried to kill them. But they don't have history as a basis, so they don't know that. So that made it even worse, because they had. So I started to write to debunk what they were saying. That's when I started writing and said, well, what you're saying makes no sense. Have you read any history? Have you paid attention to what was going on? And that's how I started.
Okay. Thank you so much. We're going to take a break, Charles, and when I return, I want you to talk more about that first book of yours, Logic, The Truth About Blacks and the Republican Party. Are you wondering what we can do about immigration? Then get your copy of my newly released book, Debating Immigration, the second edition, available at Amazon, Cambridge University Press, and all major booksellers.
The Out Loud Perspective awaits you in life, love, politics, a healthy lifestyle, your faith, personal development, and living an out loud life on AmericaOutLoud.com. Blitzer News and Entertainment Network, where you can listen 24/7 on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
I'm back with my guest, Charles Love, and he is a black conservative, and he has lots of ideas, and he shared a bit of his history, of his evolution, and we're going to talk about his work, some of his books. So tell us about the first book that you wrote.
So the first book, Logic, the Truth About Blacks and the Republican Party, was kind of where we left off, where I had friends around me, we were probably in our 30s, mid-30s at the time, who were just kind of lost. They loved Obama, they voted for Obama, they started to pay attention to what he did and said and the reactions to it, but they didn't really know any reference points of history, so I just tried to give them that. So I talk about how you can use stereotypes and certain issue, different situations with racism. So what actually is racism, and can you call everything that happened to you racist? Talk about party misconceptions. So I break down and debunk these myths about Republicans. For instance, they say that they're all racist, that they're all rich white men, that they constantly get us into wars, that they try to control social issues, that they're all religious zealots. And then I break down for each one of those why those are oversimplifications and not necessarily true. So I say, okay, you say they're all, you know, war hawks. So let's look at all the wars America got into and who was president when we got into it. So you know, you talk about LBJ and Woodrow Wilson and you know, Woodrow Wilson to the point that, you know, if you don't buy the line of the war, then you need to get locked up, and Harry Truman and all this other stuff. And like, these were all Democrats and they all went to war. So why do you say it's just Republicans? So it's just kind of like a quick snapshot of the history of the Republican Party. And what's happened since? Because, of course, as you know well now, they say, okay, fine, I can't kind of gloss over that history, so I can't change the fact that the Republican Party was started to end slavery. But what I can say is tell you that once the 60s came, they all switched, and all the racists were in the Republican Party, and the Democrats went the other way, and that's the way it's been since then. So then you have to debunk that. You know, how many people really got elected in the Democrat Party that were, you know, these freedom fighters and all the races in the Republican Party? See, none of that's true, but they don't know that. They've heard it, and they believe it. And it's just like the three-fifths rule. They hear that someone say that the Constitution says that blacks are three-fifths of a person.
Right.
And then they roll with it. They're, you know, you try to, so, you know, you just tell them that that's not really true. Actually, without it, the South would have had more power, and this is why. So you just have to, like, you're teaching adults, but you have to do it in a kind of soft way.
But
so
Charles,
I don't really attack them. Mm-hmm.
Do they really listen? Because I know that even in academia, I hear people that are well-educated, have gone to the best schools, and they believe the three-fifths myth, that blacks were three-fifths a human being. And if they don't believe it, they will say it anyway, you know, maybe to get a reaction.
Well, I would say you split it into two different groups, though, because a lot of the academics, they know, but they have an agenda they push, so they're either suppressing or they're just spinning whatever they want to spin because they have an outcome they want. But for the people who don't know, often they don't listen, which is why I had to sit back and look at, you know, watch the pros do it and say, what are they doing well and what are they not working and who are they reaching out to? So some people, I say, what they do, like Rush. What Rush does is great. He's been doing it for 30 years. He knows what he's doing, and he reaches and teaches a certain segment of the population, but there's certain people that won't listen to Rush. So I say, how can I reach those people that are falling through the cracks? So I adapted a new approach. And my approach is that to give them their argument. So I let them get to reach the conclusion that their views are wrong, rather than just saying, you're wrong, this is the truth, right? So my approach is different, so their reaction is different. I usually get fairly positive reaction from them.
Well, where do you find people? Do you do this in the barbershop, or do you get invited to black churches? Where do you get an opportunity to talk with the people who need to hear these things you're talking about?
Well, I do some of that, but the first thing, like you said, about the barbershop or whatever, my first thing is to talk everywhere, early and often. All the places they say you shouldn't, everywhere. I talk about it at work. I talk about it in the Uber. Every time I meet somebody, I bring it up. Because you never know when you're going to reach one person. You don't have to reach that many people whenever somebody brings up some topic. But as far as invitations, most of the places I get invited to are Tea Party rallies, but often colleges, which is where you want to talk to people. And I do a lot of book clubs. So a lot of middle-class blacks that choose books, and the people I know, and they suggest a book, and I go into, you know, restaurants, into people's homes, and I speak to them about, you know, because a lot of them, like I said, these are 40 to 50-year-old successful blacks. So they might say this, they're liberals, but they're not social justice warriors anymore, right? And they're like, they own homes, they got careers, so they're like, taxes are too high, and the crime in our community is too bad. So they agree with you on certain things. So I start with the points they agree on, and then work my way there. So how do we get to the parts that you don't, where we don't agree, how do you suggest we fix it? And they tend to be a lot more open that way.
I think you're right about people being more willing to listen, because I find, too, in the black community, especially among the middle-aged men and some of the women, that they're willing to, you know, to engage in conversations with conservatives. And they know that the politicians they've elected have not served them very well, and that whatever is being done and promised during an election year, that it usually doesn't address the issues that affect minority communities. And so I believe that we are at a moment in history where true change is possible, but I also believe it will take people like you, me, you know, so many others being out there trying to reach the masses with a truth that many of them have never heard before, or if they heard it, they didn't really hear it. You know, it just went over their heads.
Right. It's true. And I think when they approach it, the key is, and the second thing, what I say, so like I said, I speak to two groups. I either speak to people who are left-leaning, and I have one speech for them, and I speak to a lot of conservatives. I mentioned Tea Party groups. And what I say to them is, on policy, we agree, you know, somewhere between 80% and 90%, but your message is terrible. Let me help teach you how to take that message to people who are in the middle. And one thing I say is, you need to stop trying to make Republicans. What you want to do is, you're talking to somebody who's left-leaning or independent, you need to move them from the left. They got to make the rest of the journey on their own. So when I talk to somebody who calls themselves a liberal, I'm not trying to say, let me tell you why Trump is great. Let me tell you why Reagan was great. No, what I say is, you don't like this. You don't like high taxes. You think the schools are failing. Perhaps we should try a different way. Here, read some of these Thomas Sowell books. Think about this kind of thing. You know, and I kind of lead them down a path.
That is
but
great.
But I was just saying, Republican.
That is a great approach. And I think more of us would be able to make inroads if we followed your example. Right now, we have to take another break. And when we return, I'd like for you to talk about your latest book.
There are speakers, and then there are great speakers who know the importance of creating that memorable moment. Well, the key to any successful event is an informative and inspirational speaker. Professor Dr. Carol Swain is that gifted speaker. She delivers passionately from the heart every time. To find out more about booking Carol for your next great event, simply go to carolmswain.com. Click on Public Speaking and then click the blue Book Carol tab.
I'm back with Charles Love, and you're listening to the Be the People show. And Charles, you have a book, We Want Equality, How the Fight for Equality Gave Us Preferences. So you're talking about affirmative action. What do you mean by the fight for equality giving us preferences?
Right. So obviously not necessarily the civil rights movement, but what's happened since. So I talk about how the civil rights movement was important and necessary, but so you listen to people today on the left, they keep hearkening back to that. They mention the people who were fighting then, and they say, see, we're just carrying on their fight. But what they're asking for is totally different from what they were asking for, right? You went from, you're not treating me like I'm a man. Treat me like a man. I don't need you to hand me down anything. I just need you to stop stepping on me to, you owe me stuff, give me something. I'm going to sit down here, and then you're going to bring me something because I feel like you owe it. How they think that's the same thing is crazy. But beyond that, what I say is, give them the argument. Let's assume you do want equality. You keep saying that because that's what they marched. That's where the title came from. We want equality. It's all kind of equality. But I was like, but you don't really want equality. I coined the term, what you want is justifiable inequality. Because what you're saying is, don't treat us all the same. Treat me better. Right? You know, I noticed that, you know, when I was in high school and college, I watched and listened to people. This is, you know, the 90s, and the Cosby Show was a big hit, and they were like, it's great. We had very few black shows, so people wanted more black shows. Made perfect sense. But then those were successful, and then that made people say, no, I want even more. If you recall, Jesse Jackson and his group boycotted the Oscars because there weren't enough black people nominated. But it's just like income inequality. When you ask them, well, what do you want? I'm willing to meet you halfway. Tell me what you want. What they say they want is more.
Right.
They never give you a number. They never say we want this. So you're 13% of the population, and I can guarantee you the black social justice warriors, not the average black person, because I make it a point that I'm talking about the left, not all black people, but in the book. So when I say we're 13% of the population, what percentage of TV shows on TV should be majority black shows? They'll say, I don't know, 18, 20, 30, 35, half. None of them are going to say 13.
It's never enough.
Yep.
There will never be enough. And I don't believe that the political left will ever give up on anything. Like right now, there are demands for reparations, slave reparations. Mm-hmm. And we know that if the government or governments acquiesced and gave reparations, that it wouldn't end the demand for more.
That's exactly right. And I actually talk about reparations, actually, which surprises people as a conservative. I said, but think of what I say. I'm not talking about today. I said reparations was the proper answer, not affirmative action, because think about what we said we wanted, right? And then it would have been different because you're not talking about past ills. You're saying you passed the Civil Rights Act. Really, you should do it in Reconstruction, but it probably was still too much animosity at the time. But after you signed the Civil Rights Act, you're basically saying yesterday there was Jim Crow, so it's not that long ago. But what the problem with affirmative action is because it's not equal, because you're saying, I want to give a certain group of people a leg up in a job. I want to give them first preference for this or that. You know, get more of them in school, even if you have to lower the requirements. No, reparations would have been better, because we would say, okay, starting today, 1965, all the laws are the same, equally applied to everybody. But we understand that this group had a disadvantage for a long period of time, so we're going to give them X, and you put a time limit on it, right? So that would have been the key. You would say free education at a public school, college for two generations, and if people would prefer to go into an apprenticeship, we would pay the apprenticeship for this period of time. It's got a deadline on it, it's done.
That
but out, Right, but then you're saying, but outside of that, everybody else is equal. Everything, there's no preference in jobs, no preference in school, no preference here. And eventually, it would weed out and everything would be equal. When you say affirmative action and you do it in perpetuity, now it's, 50 years later, and we're still saying, well, we need to give them more jobs. We need to give them free college. We need to lower standards for them. And it's not helping. They're going to keep doing it, and it's going to keep being unsuccessful.
I agree, and as I said before, there'll never be enough because there's too much at stake for the people that have a vested interest in keeping America divided.
Yeah, and then they say it goes through everything. In the book, I talk about income inequality, I talk about gender equality, religion, everything. Income equality, you say same work for same job. I mean, same pay for the same job, but you don't mean that. In the book, I say, okay, LeBron James is the power forward for the Cleveland Cavaliers at the time. So is Larry Nance Jr. They both have to show up to the same practices, play with the same uniform, get on the same bus ride. LeBron makes $33 million. He makes $1.2. How's that fair? They're making the same job. Because you don't really mean it. In your job, if you work with someone else and you're doing a better job and he got a raise and you get a raise and he got a raise just because you get a raise and he was doing a bad job, you would say that's unfair. So don't say you want equal pay for you. You don't really want that. You just want more pay.
What's your opinion of this? What's your opinion of the white privilege movement? The fact that on college campuses now, every white person is told that they have privileges because of their skin color,
and that it's silly. I wonder what's worse: the fact that they're doing that, or the fact that so many white people have such white guilt that they're buying into it. Where are the people who just stand up and like, I'm not going to feel guilty because of what you're saying? What I would say is, more of us, they're missing out on the privilege that they really have. What there really is American privilege and two-parent privilege.
You're right. That's right.
You look at the numbers of the people who grew up with both of their parents and look at where they are versus their friends who grew up in single-family homes. That's a privilege. And then, of course, America as a whole. You take the average poor person in America and compare it to anyone else, anywhere else in the world, those people are fighting and clamoring to get where you are. It's not even the same. So your way of life and the way you live is so much better because you're here. So that's a privilege in itself. So everybody born in America is born with a default privilege. And then beyond that, if you have both parents, you have another privilege. That's the real privilege. Because if you're white and you grow up in rural America and with one parent, you're struggling just like the black person.
That's right. That's right. And we're running out of time, and I need you to take a minute and tell our listeners about your summit that's planned for this fall.
Right. So it's called the National Minority Conservative Summit. What we're doing is trying to take a lot of conservative events that they have an event in like D.C. or some city, you have to all go there and you fellowship and you hear great speakers and it's wonderful, but everybody can afford to take a weekend off, take off work, pay the high fee, fly all over the place. So we want to bring that to you. So we're going to come to most of the 5 to 6 largest cities in several battleground states where the conservatives are really trying to make headway, and in urban areas like Detroit and Houston and things of that nature, and bring out speakers to talk about issues. So it's not a campaign thing. It's not a GOP thing. It's just a bunch of minority conservatives saying, this is what's important. So we will have someone come out and speak, do a 10-minute speech on free speech. And then we'll have a panel discuss it, a couple questions, go on to the next speech. The next speech might be, like you mentioned, some of the white privilege might be a topic. How to, help your kids navigate through liberal schools if they're not liberal.
That's right.
What to do about criminal justice reform from a conservative standpoint. So things of that nature. We're going to be in multiple cities. It's all going to be on the same date, the weekend of October 26th, and pretty soon you'll see it blasting all over the place.
And Charles, I thank you so much for being on the Be the People show, and we will post information online about your books and anything else you would like our listeners to be able to access. And so thank you again for being on the Be the People show.
Thank you for having me.
And for the rest of you all, the sign off. It's we the people. We're responsible for the nation we have. And it's up to us to be the people who change America and our world. Until next time.